Morning, everybody. On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. President Obama's executive actions on gun regulation announced this week seek, in part, to put more muscle behind enforcement of current federal statutes.
What President Obama did in many respects with these new executive actions is to actually give the federal government better capability to enforce the laws on the books, and this is meaningful.
Dr. Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and the chair of Baltimore's Homicide Review Commission. We begin today with a conversation about what the federal and state governments can do legislatively to reverse the horrendous uptick in the number of homicides and shootings in Baltimore. And our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday, weigh in with their suggestions of what to see at the cinema as Oscar competition heats up. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan Sterner has the local headlines. Maryland Morning starts right after the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. This week, President Obama once again brought the issue of gun violence to the fore of the American conversation. On Tuesday, the president described a series of executive actions he's taking to address the problem. And last night, he held a national town hall meeting about guns that was broadcast on CNN. Widely believe that Maryland has gun control laws that are among the strongest in the country, and at the same time, last year the city of Baltimore had the highest per capita homicide rate in the city's history. The Maryland legislature begins their 2016 session next week. Is there more that could be done legislatively to curb the influx of illegal guns and to strengthen current laws? My first guest this morning thinks there is. Dr. Daniel Webster is an internationally recognized expert on gun policy. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Dr. Webster, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So first, your reaction to the president's initiative. I mean, briefly, he talks about background checks, requiring people who are selling guns to be licensed and to require their buyers to have background checks. He wants to modernize that system. He wants to ensure effective enforcement of existing laws, hiring more ATF agents. He wants to focus on mental illness and gun safety technology. What do you think?
I'm actually very excited and enthused about what the president did. Certainly, I think many of us, certainly experts in this area, would have loved to be attending a session where he is signing a law, a new law that Congress passed that extend background checks and do many more things that need to be done to strengthen our gun laws. But I think the president identified really important things that can and should be done. He said he was going to act. He did. I think that these are meaningful actions.
But even he admitted that, you know, without congressional legislative action, it is limited.
Undoubtedly.
And then, of course, there's the notion of what can the federal government do and state ordinances as well and state laws. And you've done a lot of research on that, too.
Yes. Just on the federal level. Enforcement is incredibly important, and I think in the world of gun policy, it doesn't get enough attention. When it does get attention, often, frankly, it's to deflect. When opponents don't want to think about stronger gun laws, they simply say, well, we got to enforce the laws on the books. What President Obama did in many respects with these new executive actions is to make that real, to actually give the federal government better capability to enforce the laws on the books. And this is meaningful. There are ATF agents and U.S. prosecutors who are really hamstrung. They know quite well in many cases who is supplying violent criminals with guns, but they don't have the resources or the clarity in their law in all cases to actually address those problems. That's something I think we can also address here locally in Maryland, because there is only so much the federal government is going to be able to do. Actually, it's sort of a very interesting comparison when you think about drug law enforcement and gun law enforcement. Baltimore doesn't rely entirely upon the DEA to address the drug problem. They tackle it, and state prosecutors do as well. very commonly, I'm not talking specifically about Baltimore necessarily, this is widespread across the nation, there's been a mindset with local and state law enforcement officials when they think about gun trafficking, they just say, ah, that's ATF's problem. Well, ATF has bad laws and few resources. President Obama is trying to address some of those things.
Martin O'Malley and others have touted the strength of Maryland's gun laws for quite a bit of time, and and more intensely perhaps these last few months as he's been running for president. Is that true? I mean, there's this perception that Maryland has these really tough gun laws. Is that true?
Well, Maryland certainly has a number of very important gun laws to work with. First and foremost, they require background checks for all handgun sales. They now, as of 2013, have a licensing system for handgun purchasers as well. Those two things we found are important. Very important things done in 2013 with the Firearm Safety Act that sadly rarely gets mentioned is that we put more teeth in the state police being able to regulate licensed gun sellers. And we also put in a requirement that gun owners promptly report guns that are lost or stolen. This is important because very commonly when they're trying to identify who is supplying guns to criminals, a common alibi, if you will, or response is, oh, I don't know how that gun got in that person's hands. They must have stolen it. But Maryland still could do some very important things to really make their current laws work far better with very modest changes that really would affect almost no gun owners. It would not inconvenience them at all. Basically, while we have a background check requirement for private sales, the way the law is written, prosecutors have found very difficult to actually get convictions on because they haven't adequately defined what it means to transfer a gun and distinguish that from a temporary loan.
It's like a difference between, you know, selling somebody a gun and letting somebody borrow the gun.
Yes. So sadly, defendants have been able to claim when prosecutors bring cases that they've transferred guns to people without background checks to claim, oh, I didn't transfer it, that was just a loan. And the law doesn't say you have to have a background check for a loan. So I think we need to tighten that law and clarify so what is required so that when guns are transferred, there must be background checks. And then finally, our penalties are incredibly weak for what I consider to be a very serious crime that harms public safety. When you are not taking the actions you're supposed to and it ends up with a lethal weapon in the hand of a dangerous person, that's a serious crime. And right now, our penalties are so weak that prosecutors aren't particularly enthused about spending their time bringing those cases.
Of course, people who oppose further legislative action on guns would point to the fact that, you know, despite the strength of this law, the relative strength, you know, compared to other states at least, we still have this very, you know, pernicious problem of gun violence here in the state of Maryland. I mean, does your data suggest that these laws, that a legislative fix is, in fact, a fix?
We've been studying state gun laws for a long time across the board, not just in Maryland. We found pretty compelling evidence that comprehensive background check requirements, particularly when they're accompanied by a handgun purchaser permitting system, is quite effective in reducing diversions of guns to criminals. We found evidence that it lowers homicide rates, lowers suicide rates. So, yes, we have found evidence that these laws work, but there's a whole lot of difference from state to state. You can't simply look at a given state and what their rate of, or city for that matter, and their homicide rate and conclude by that alone whether a law does or doesn't work. Each city and state has its own unique demographic, economic, social challenges, and what you really need to do is compare how these trends change when laws change. And that's what we do with our research.
So is that an argument then for uniformity of gun laws across the country, which seems like it would never happen? I mean, people in the West have a different notion of what a gun ownership is, perhaps, than people in, you know, populous cities in the East. But for example, you know, in New York, some folks in New York report as many as 90% of the guns used in crimes in New York come from out of state. Your data suggests that about 40% or so, 44% of Maryland guns used in crimes come from out of state. And this is because the other states have more lax gun laws.
Right. You're absolutely right. There is a very, very strong correlation between how strong your gun laws are and whether guns move from your state to somebody else's state to be used in crime. But what we found is that there appears to be an important cost to that kind of transfer. You used the example of New York City. If 90% of their guns used by criminals in New York City come from out of state, what that clearly signals is that there's a local scarcity of guns. The price of guns on the underground gun market in New York City has been found to be 5 to 6 times higher than it would be in certain cities and states with very lax laws.
And that's a good thing, then, right? That's
an absolutely good thing. So it indicates scarcity. It indicates higher cost for criminal acquisition, and it translates into less gun crime.
You are the head of the Homicide Review Commission here in Baltimore. There was a lot in the news about the commission last fall, August and September. Marilyn Mosby, the new state's attorney at that time, seemed to be opposed to the work of the commission. What's the status of that committee now?
So just to clarify, Ms. Mosby was not opposed to the work of the commission. She had concerns about what kind of cases and information would be reviewed as part of that. We needed to sit down and figure out what everybody was comfortable with what data would be examined and shared and so on.
She had concerns about data in ongoing cases being shared with the commission.
Particularly, she was concerned about any case that had not been fully adjudicated, and concerns that information remained secure. So what we eventually needed to do is to go back to older cases, and that's what we have done in the commission. Also, of course, one of the things that delayed our progress on this was what happened following the Freddie Gray funeral and the uprising. So very understandably, the police department, as well as the state's attorney's office, were incredibly busy responding to first the unrest and then the surge in violence. So
things back on track now? You expect to have a report in a few months?
Yes, absolutely. Things are back on track. We've been analyzing the data. We've been reviewing cases. We'll be sharing that information at the end of this month with key leaders, and then we'll finalize a report that we hope to have in February.
Daniel Webster is the director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. We'll have a link to information about President Obama's executive actions concerning gun regulations on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Dr. Webster, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Hall. Coming up later in the run-up to the Oscars, a rundown of what's currently in theaters that you'll want to catch. Jed Dietz and Anne Hornaday join me after a break for the news. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Hi, yes, a great and grand, glorious Maryland morning tradition continues with the single cheesiest version of Hooray for Hollywood. Once again, announcing in the new year, for the 10th year running now, that it is time for the monthly Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival joins us, as always, to speak about the current cinema. Mr. Dietz, good to see you, sir.
Good morning.
And Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So there's this little movie that came out very little notice called Star Wars. I think Tina Fey and Amy Poehler noticed it because it came out the same weekend as their movie, you know. But it wasn't quite overshadowed by Sisters. So let's just jump right in. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of movies that folks may want to catch this weekend. The Golden Globes are Sunday night, and so now the awards thing are, you know, it's all heating up. So, Anne, I mean, is Star Wars a good movie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I enjoyed it. I think it did what it needed to do, because now we're entering this new
kind of chapter, a new era in terms of the Star Wars narrative, and they're launching another sort of grouping of sequels, prequels, reboots, whatever you want to call them. So I think what this movie needed to do was sort of reestablish some territory that was seeded during the prequel years, which I
this
think
this is narrative territory we're talking
narrative
about.
And also just bringing some reminding people of what the sort of first principles of the franchise were always about. And so I think J.J. Abrams, the director, really did that. He brought back the three major stars from the original movie in a thought really graceful, meaningful way, especially Harrison Ford. He's wonderful in the movie. And then he introduced some great new characters that I think people are going to be excited about following. I mean, the knock on the film is that it's kind of a retread of the first movie, and I get it. It's almost like a remake in terms of hitting so many of the same plot points and beats, but it's been so long that I think we needed that, and now we're going to see where they take it. And I'm very eager and, dare I say, optimistic about what Rian Johnson will do with the next one.
Mm-hmm. So, Jed Dietz, this is the first movie, or we should say it's the fastest movie to get to $1 billion in gross revenues in the history of movie making. I mean, the phenomenon of this thing, the financial phenomenon of this, what did it cost them, $200 million to make or something like that?
Something like that, and they bought the big investment was in buying Lucasfilm when Disney bought Lucasfilm for $4 billion. And they got a lot of criticism for it. People thought they'd really overpaid and this franchise was tired and et cetera, et cetera. And I think just a nod to the Disney people, I mean, Anne's right. It starts with the art and the storytelling and the acting and Larry Kasdan, who participated in the script, who had written one of the early ones and, all that team was the right team to assemble, but they've handled it so beautifully. I mean, this is the kind of thing that the financial pressure could have put you into really overhype mode and panic mode, and they just didn't do that.
It's certainly that they didn't underhype the movie before it came out.
But I
started seeing stories about this movie a year before. I mean, I started seeing stories before they shot it. they assembled Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher and then the gang, and they're pictures on Facebook of, it was even before a table read. I mean, so they started thinking about it a long time ago.
But in a way that worked. I mean, I guess, you have to go back to the quality of the movie, because if the movie wasn't there, none of that would have mattered enough. But, all of those marketing tie-ins, it was just beautiful and skillfully done. I think the fact that that it hasn't yet opened in China to ramp up the box office, so there's many more dollars coming this franchise's way, and people are revisiting the movie multiple times. I mean, it's doing all the things a piece of great art can do.
And to Jed's point about how Disney handled it well, I mean, when so much is at stake, the default is to just play it way too safe. And they allowed Abrams to cast these new faces, which was just a brilliant stroke on his part. I mean, we've been watching people like Oscar Isaac. He's well known to people who go to movies a lot, but not to the general public. Right. And someone like an Adam Driver, who was really best known for a little HBO show, and then this wonderful Daisy Ridley.
Girls.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So, thank
Daisy
goodness.
Ridley. Yeah.
Oh, and she's...
Ridley, excuse me.
Yeah, and she's kind of the revelation of the whole thing. So I think that's what I think they did so brilliantly well, is to know when to cede control, to an Abrams and let him do what he wanted to do.
What does this movie do for a young actress like Daisy Ridley or a sort of, mid-level guy like Adam Driver? This is not his first movie by any means. Mm-mm. I've seen him in a bunch of movies. Mm-hmm. And, I think of like Jennifer Lawrence and the Hunger Games franchise. She, I think, understood that once she did that role, that she was no longer this little indie actress. Is this going to be gigantic for them?
Of course. And I think it's a new kind of career model for these actors to take. I mean, like Michael Fassbender is another really good example. I mean, he came out of the indie world. He was really best known for his work with Steve McQueen, the British director. And then he gets an X-Men. He gets a franchise, and that can really become a way for them to put body and, keep body and soul together and make a living, and then, keep exploring and doing work that they want to do to grow as an actor.
All right. Well, if you are one of the seven people who hasn't yet seen Star Wars, here's a little taste.
Thank you.
That's it. Chewie, we're home. I'm delighted. I don't know. I'm quitting now. We're done. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Back to NPR. I'm going to the movies. That's it. It's got me hooked.
I laughed. I cried.
Yeah, right. I mean, the music is unbelievable. John Williams, you know, and I saw a piece that I think 60 Minutes did with J.J. Abrams running around the studio when they were recording the soundtrack, like a little kid, you know, a starstruck little kid taking pictures of John Williams. Mm. I knew John Williams in the 70s when I was a graduate student. Wow. He was the conductor of the Boston Pops. Mm. He was the most gracious, wonderful, outgoing guy. Mm. I mean, he was just lovely. We would hang out at his rehearsals and stuff, and he was always very nice to all of us young conductors and stuff.
Aww.
So, you know, the music is just unbelievable.
The audience I saw started cheering as the thing scrolled.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and that's what you feel like. It's like, oh, it's so... And I realized after I had seen it, I was smiling all day. I was walking around just feeling so good. And I think, you know, you got to give it up for a movie that's able to do that, you know, to put a smile on your face.
Because the 20-somethings that I've talked to who've seen this movie have seen it four times, you know, which is really something.
Wow.
And then there's a mini debate going on whether or not it should be seen in 3D or in regular.
Indeed.
Is it 2D, 1D, whatever the...
2D.
2D,
well,
is that it? Yeah. So did you see it in 3D?
I did see it in 3D, yeah. And I'm fascinated by what's happening with 3D, because I think for the first time in the history of 3D, and of course it goes back to the 50s, it's now evolving away from just being a stunt and being really an organic part of a movie. And I think it worked beautifully with The Martian in 3D, and really you sort of forget it's not gimmicks anymore. It's really part of you know, mm-hmm. how you're experiencing a movie. And I think when it's used right, it can really be great.
Because 3D's been around a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the 50s, right? Maybe
something like that. It was a way to tear people. It was one of those ways to overcome the challenge of television. And for my purposes, I'm anti-3D as a rule. I've found that it detracts more than it adds, especially with visual values. I feel like it often sacrifices clarity, it sacrifices color range and tone, and it sacrifices some brightness and clarity. And I would rather have all of those things than a third dimension. However, I think Jed's exactly right that there are some cases where they've brought the technology along enough to where it's really become an organic aesthetic element. And you know, for something like Gravity, for example, I would have urged people to see that in 3D. I think it was additive in that case. I have not seen Star Wars in 3D yet, and now you're convincing me that I should.
Yeah, that's interesting because
you're welcome, Disney.
I had no idea that it does attenuate color and
for my yes, I think in the past that has been my main
criticism.
I've not
noticed. I saw Avatar in 3D. And
well, so did I, and that's when I, you know, and I would what I do is I take the glasses off and I look and I compare and look, and that was a problem for me with Avatar because I felt like the colors of that world were so vibrant, and you lost a lot of saturation and a lot of tonal range with those with the 3D and the glasses.
Mm-hmm. Quentin Tarantino has a new movie, and speaking of the way it's broadcast, would it be 3D or 2D, he insisted, at least for about 100 theaters, I guess, at the opening of this, that it be screened in 70 millimeter film. So it's called The Hateful Eight. So, Jed, what was this? Was this just a little marketing thing, or is this Mr. Tarantino being the artiste who insists that, you know, my work can only be seen in this particular way?
Probably a little bit of both. I mean, it's too expensive to have not had... Somebody was thinking it had some marketing power.
Because theaters had to be retrofitted to be able to screen these films in 70 millimeter.
Yeah,
didn't they have to actually buy a bunch of 70 millimeter projectors?
Rent them.
Or rent them.
And then they hired Boston Light and Sound, which is a company we're working on actually with the Parkway, have worked with them. It's a terrific operation to even place projectionists around, because, you know, most screening rooms now, most megaplexes, the people who work there have never projected film. And or if they did, it was a long time ago.
It's all projected in DVD, so they press the button like we do at home.
Yeah, well, or hard drive. It comes out of a hard drive. But it's digital projection and digital form.
So what do you gain by 70 millimeter as opposed to digital?
Well, I wasn't sure. I went out to see it at White Marsh in what's called the Roadshow. So you get an overture, and you get an intermission. There's a souvenir book like the Roadshow films of the 70s. And I was just curious to see what this was like. And the first image, which is a mountain image that hits the screen, is just takes your breath away. And there's, you know, I'm a big fan of digital. I think it's been great. I've heard the newest restoration of Lawrence of Arabia, which is a digital restoration everybody says is the best one, better than the 70 millimeter. But this was a whole different visual experience to see it. And you got, you know, it was an audience full of people who were sort of experiencing this way to go to movies that had been abandoned.
But it's better. And I mean, I don't know anything about the tech of this. So, I mean, is 70 millimeter better than digital? I don't know.
I think we're at a point now where, and we're going to be talking about a movie called The Revenant, which also has this big screen scale and scope that was entirely shot on digital in natural light. And it's gorgeous, too. So I feel like that debate is almost over. You know, I used to be such a preservationist when it came to celluloid. And I still am. I mean, I'm really happy that Tarantino's out there advocating that it be preserved, because first of all, it's still the best archival form for film. But it does bring, I think that celluloid does have, again, those textural values, that translucence that digital is really catching up on, but still doesn't have, just as a material object. It does not have the same qualities as a medium. So I'm happy. It's always nice to see people working around the range.
Yeah, and Anne, you wrote an absolutely beautiful essay in the Post a few days ago about these two movies, Hateful Eight and Revenant, in the context of violence and violence in movies and the history of violence in movies. So let's talk first about these two movies just as movies. Mm. Is The Hateful Eight a good movie?
Well, it starts out, yes, until it isn't. I mean, I'm with Jed. That sort of initial image and where it takes you in the first several minutes is just wonderful. It's Robert Richardson shot it. It looks beautiful. Ennio Morricone wrote the score. It's a beautiful musical score. You've got Kurt Russell, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Samuel Jackson, Walter Goggins just delivering a completely revelatory performance. So all of these elements are emplaced and running along and chugging on all cylinders, and then they all land in this cabin where I feel that the big 70 millimeter scope was completely squandered, because it turns into kind of a parlor game and a mystery, almost like an Agatha Christie mystery story that's really contained into these four walls. So I feel like visually it becomes much less interesting right away, and then the story just goes haywire. And for my money, I mean, what was going on before the intermission was actually really provocative and interesting, and I was with them, and then it all kind of goes, it all just goes away after the second.
Jed, you saw it as well. What did you think?
Yeah, I didn't have that problem. I thought the first part of it sort of teed up the Tarantino finish, and a lot of your reaction will be how you feel about his films. And I just think he's, as opposed to The Revenant, which we'll get into in a minute, but I think he's got this theme that he's been working on a lot about the insanity of violence, and he gets you there through this sort of cartoonish way of showing you violence. Lots of blood, lots of explicit damage done to bodies, but you almost can't help but laugh at some of this stuff as it's happening, and it's so crazy. And he intends you to laugh, and I think he's, through his films, he's helping you just see how insane vengeance and all that stuff.
And for what it's worth, that's my own particular problem with Mr. Tarantino, because I don't laugh. I mean, I don't think there's anything funny about that kind of brutality and violence. And he does, or he thinks that we will. And so we're going to talk about this notion of violence in movie after a break for the news. But before we get to that, let's talk in terms of The Revenant as well, because these are two very violent movies, both set around the same time, sometime post-Civil War in the American West. This is Leonardo DiCaprio, who by all accounts gives a very good performance. Mm-hmm. But is this a good movie?
Well, again, it's for my quibbles with this movie are very similar to the Tarantino in terms of just being so aesthetically and technically gorgeous. I mean, it's just been beautifully shot in these widescreen landscapes that are positively breathtaking. This is actually a pre-Civil War story, but it's set in the American West of the 19th century, like Hateful Eight. But it, you cannot quibble with the technical and aesthetic prowess that's on hand here, but all thrown at what, for my purposes, is really a puny little story that just didn't merit the virtuosity taken to.
I mean, this is a guy getting mauled by a bear. So, what do you think, Jed? Does the movie succeed?
A bear is played by Freddy Krueger. I mean, this monster,
a really bad bear.
Yeah, and I think the great fault of this movie is that it's boring, mm-hmm. and it's a one note story. And I think they wanted it to lift into something mystical, and it just doesn't get there.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about, in particular, your essay in the Post about this use of violence. Yeah. Tarantino, of course, being one of the great provocateurs with that. That's all coming up after a little break for the news. You're listening to Maryland Morning on 88.1. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, Ann Hornaday from the Washington Post. I'm Tom Hall. We will be back after a break. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan, and welcome back to part two of the Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem, picking up with Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival and Ann Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about violence in movies. We, before the break, mentioning The Hateful Eight, the new film by Quentin Tarantino, along with Revenant, the new movie about the guy and his bear, Leonardo DiCaprio. And Anne, you wrote an essay, as I said before the break, that I just thought was terrific. Talking about The Revenant, you talked about the problem of making an equivalence between suffering and moral seriousness. Mm, mm. So there really is a difference. I mean, this guy suffers. He gets mm-hmm. mauled by a bear. And mm-hmm. then the rest of the movie, I guess, is about his revenge for that mm-hmm. act. But is this a notion of moral seriousness?
It's something that has always kind of bothered me, because I think it's an assumption that a lot of filmmakers make, which is if I put the bodies of my actors through hell, that somehow that conveys a lot of moral meanings that I don't have to really otherwise engage or take any kind of pains to express. And I think often it's sort of used as shorthand. It's used as a way to both shock the audience and almost sort of beat them into submission in a way. So I've always been interested in this notion, and it's not always just violence. I mean, you can see people suffer from illness on, you know, there's a lot of different ways that filmmakers have deployed human suffering on screen. And but seeing Hateful Eight and Revenant in such close proximity, the fact that they're being released in such close proximity, I wanted to kind of go back to this subject again, working it out through these two movies and why. In both cases, I kind of didn't accept what the filmmaker was doing. I think in Tarantino's case, he is engaging in that same ironic distance that he so often has. Now, I will say, like in Django Unchained, I thought it worked. I mean, I thought that his sort of audacious choice to tell the story of American slavery or process it through the spaghetti Western genre actually did work to kind of heighten the insanity and pathology of white supremacy in the antebellum South. I think he's trying, you know, he makes motions and nods toward that same subject matter in Hateful Eight, but in a way that I don't feel is mm-hmm. is enlightening or takes it anywhere further. And again, I just think that final kind of grand guignol bloodbath, he's not telling me anything I don't already know.
Yeah, and Jed Ann mentions in her piece other movies, Son of Saul, a movie that's opening mm-hmm. In a little bit. We may not have a chance to talk about that today, but we'll talk about it next month. Even Spotlight mm-hmm. or Room, there's horrible violence that occurs in these movies, but it occurs in a, you know, in the background, and you're not, it's not thrown in your face. This is my own personal problem with Mr. Tarantino. If he can't tell the story without that stuff, it seems to me that that indicates a paucity of imagination.
Well, I think that's fair, but I think it's who he is as an artist and has been from the beginning. I mean, he's fascinated by the way, it's interesting, by the way movies have taken on violence, and I think he's pushed it in a way that gets Anne and all of us to some degree thinking about how you use art to depict violence and where are the boundaries. And I would also agree that I think Django is a more powerful movie, better use of this technique. But I think, especially compared to The Revenant, I mean, Hateful Eight is a celebration of the movie art form. It's a celebration of parts of the genre, especially when you see it in the 70 millimeter roadshow presentation. And I think, so it's artifice, so obviously artifice, mm-hmm. and not about the profundity. It's about have fun at this and then think about it.
Maybe
later.
It's kind of like minimalist music. I mean, if you go hear a piece by Phil Glass, you're going to have to say, okay, Phil doesn't write melodies. Mm-hmm. He writes the same chord.
Don't ask somebody to do what they don't, yeah, what they ever, don't do. Never so, intended yeah. to. I think that's a fair yeah. point. Yeah.
There's a movie, Anne, called Animalisa, which is coming out. This seems mm-hmm. pretty interesting. It's a blend of CGI and stop motion mm-hmm. puppetry. Duke Johnson, Charlie Kaufman directed. It won the Grand Jury Prize at the Venice Film Festival. This seems really mm-hmm. interesting. What's
it is
about?
Really interesting. It's Charlie Kaufman is best known for writing Being John Malkovich and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, also Adaptation. So he's a very cerebral filmmaker, and he's, again, engaging with all of these very intellectual ideas in this movie in a really charming, very tender, creative way.
Here's a little clip from Animalisa.
Okay.
What is it to be human? What is it to ache? What is it to be alive? Each person you speak to has had a day. Some of the days have been good, some bad. Each person you speak to has had a childhood. Each has a body. Each body has aches.
He's not backing away from the big issues there, is he, Jed?
Well, and he's also done something very bold, because this is all told through stop-action animation and puppets. The voices are David Thewlis, the great British actor, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's also in Hateful Eight, completely different role, and then all the other voices by a wonderful character actor named Tom Noonan. This is the kind of thing that could have been cloying and gimmicky and, you know, and it just isn't. I mean, what Anne mm-hmm. said is exactly right. It's a pretty serious exploration of a specific psychological condition and of feeling alone in the world, in the modern world. And it's terrific.
All right. Mm-hmm. Animalisa looks like mm-hmm. it's going to open at the Charles Theater in Baltimore next week. All right. Let's do a little bit of sort of lightning round here, because we just got a couple of minutes left. And the Danish Girl. What do you think?
I'm not a huge fan. I mean, it's a really interesting story that I think was a little bit squandered in this film. It's by Tom Hooper, who did The King's Speech and also Les Miserables. I don't think he's a very instinctive filmmaker. I don't think he has the cinematic instincts of a Tarantino or even an Iñárritu, for that matter. The one, I think the saving grace of it is this amazing performance by Alicia Vikander,
yeah.
Who's probably going to be nominated for an Oscar for it, and she's mm-hmm. just terrific.
And it's funny, Eddie Redmayne, who won the Oscar for the Hawkins film, he was the one everybody was talking about, and I totally agree with Anne. The revelation in this is Alicia Vikander, mm-hmm. who's just mm-hmm. fantastic.
Joy, the team that hooked up for Silver Linings Playbook, yeah. Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, Robert De Niro, David Russell directed it. What do you think?
This is kind of a crazy screwball comedy, wacky movie about a real life woman who invented the miracle mop and became a huge star and entrepreneur on QVC, one of the early QVC pioneers. Tonally, it's all over the map. It's very undisciplined and unruly and ungovernable, and I can't really defend it on artistic grounds, because I'm not sure. You know, I know that it's not a home run success, but there's something about this movie that just got under my skin, mostly because it's Jennifer Lawrence just commanding the screen in the most. I mean, it just proves, as if we needed proof, she is movie magic. And I loved where the story went, and I kind of loved its chaotic lack of focus.
Mm-hmm. Just got 20 seconds left. What do you think of The Big Short, Jed?
I love The Big Short. It comes from a book that I also admire tremendously, that Michael Lewis wrote, who also wrote Moneyball and,
Blindside.
That's mm-hmm. exactly right. But this book is a really dense. He's done a lot. He comes out of the investment world, and it's very, very dense. And this has been made by Adam McKay, who did worked with Will Ferrell, completely sort of goofy, and I think it really worked.
All right, Jed Dietz, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. Anne Hornaday is the film critic for the Washington Post. We've got a link to the film festival website, as well as Anne Hornaday's really terrific essay about violence in the movies, on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time. We'll talk about the Oscars.
Great.
That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, the next installment of our monthly series, The Accountability Index. We'll have a roundup of local news with WBAL's Jane Miller and Yvonne Wenger of the Baltimore Sun. J. Wynn Russick reviews the new show at the Spotlighters Theater, and Jonna McCone profiles local rapper Abdu Ali. That's all coming up Maryland Morning on Monday. Thanks for joining us.